In the last time, we talked about the great speckled bird, if you remember, the great speckled bird. And in that sermon, we talked about birds of various different kinds. We mentioned birds of prey, such as eagles and vultures and hawks. But we didn't have the time. I wanted to go into the subtopic of migration, and we didn't have time for that. So just want it, and it leads into my sermon today. Actually, it's going to be a sermon series, if that's okay. And so let's correct that omission today, and let's talk about migration. And in this new sermon series, I want to examine the migrations of mankind, all the way from the time of Adam and Eve, going all the way up through Abraham, and right into the children of Israel, the early church era, and all the way up to the Church of God in our time. And along the way, I want to see if, and I believe there is, I want to see if there's anything that we can learn from these migrations. Do any of these migrations, are any of them applicable to God's church today? So if you want to write it down, the title of the series is The ABC of Scattering. The ABC of Scattering. And the ABC is Abraham, again, Abraham, Babel or Babel, and the church. Abraham, Babel, and the church. Okay, well, let's begin at the beginning. Well, close to the beginning anyway, at creation. Actually, at the recreation. The recreation. First, let's examine the period going from Adam to Noah. And let's go all the way back, please, to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. And beginning at verse 27. Genesis 1, 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. Blessed the man and the woman, or men and women. And God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. So this first command that God gave to Adam and Eve, it was that men and women, starting with those two, were to replenish the earth. What does replenish mean? Well, just looking at it from the Hebrew is quite straightforward. An English thesaurus tells us that it means to refill, to restock, and to reload. And those words imply that the earth had been filled, had been stocked, and had been loaded at some time prior to the time that God said these words to Adam and Eve. And we look at the first two verses of the book of Genesis there. And during the time between those two verses, we think of that as the prehistoric era. And during that time, an archangel by the name of Hallel, not Lucifer, Hallel was his name, and he was given charge over the earth. And likely we believe that that was also the age of the dinosaurs. But things went badly, and there was war in heaven. And the earth became tohu and bohu. It became without form and void. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. So, in order for it to be replenished, it badly needed a makeover. And God provided that makeover in what we think of as Recreation Week. Recreation Week, and we read about that throughout Genesis chapters 1 and 2. You don't have to turn there, but Psalm 104 verse 30 tells us that God renewed the face of the earth. God renewed the face of the earth. But still in Genesis chapter 1, and continuing now in verse 29, and God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth." Every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat, or for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creeps upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat, food. And it was so. So what this tells us here, that God had not only created animals and trees and plants in Eden, but also across the face of the whole earth. Adam and Eve and their progeny were given a huge task, it says here, of properly looking after all of it as caretakers. But in order for Adam and Eve to start replenishing the earth with a human population, in order to look after all of those treasures, those animals and fish and birds and everything, Adam and Eve needed to get started without delay into being fruitful and multiplying. Let's go over to chapter 2, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." But Halel was still around, but his name had been changed to Satan. And Satan came along and so easily diverted the attention of Adam and Eve from cleaving to each other, as they were supposed to be doing, and from being fruitful and multiplying. He diverted their attention from those things to messing around with two trees. And that delayed them from their priority, the priority job that God had given them. It's the first thing that God told them to do, and they put it on the back burner. Once they got the hang of it, they were on their way. But they didn't get the hang of it, apparently, till after the Lord expelled them from Eden. Genesis chapter 3 now. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 23. "Therefore, the Lord God sent him forth," talking about Adam, but of course Eve's with him, "sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken. So he drove out the man," "and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life." Now, so God sent him forth, God drove him out, and this driving out and this sending forth of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden is actually the very beginning of the migration of Adam and Eve and of their extended family. Along came Cain and Abel. They were begotten and they were born after Adam and Eve's expulsion from the garden, from what we understand here. Now, to be able, once again, to be able to replenish the whole earth, as we're going to see as we go along, Adam and Eve and their progeny were not permitted to be absentee landlords. The Lord, Yahweh, expected them to get out there and to rule it all on site, in person. Once Cain grew up, he wasn't allowed to stay home with his mum and dad. Again, remember what they were commanded in chapter 2. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother. And that was important back then. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother. But after Cain murdered his brother, the Lord sent him on his way too, just like with his parents. Genesis chapter 4, and this is the Lord speaking here to Cain. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 12. When you till the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto you her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shall you be in the earth. That was when he kicked Cain out. He told him that he had to be a fugitive and a vagabond. And now jump down to verse 14. This is Cain replying to God, or actually rather whining to God. Verse 14: Behold, you have driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from your face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth, and it shall come to pass that every one that finds me shall slay me. Which is not very logical, but the main thing that I'm trying to get at there is God told him that he was going to be a fugitive and a vagabond, and that yes, he did drive him out. He did drive him away, and he admitted that he was going to be a fugitive and a vagabond. So just like Adam and Eve, as a result of their sin, Cain too was driven out. But he was driven out as a fugitive and a vagabond. What do those two words mean? We probably have our own ideas of what they mean. But if we look at the Hebrew words, the first word, fugitive, is translated from the Hebrew verb, by the way, it's a verb, not a noun, nuwa, N-U-W-A, Strong's 5128. It's got lots of meanings, but many of the meanings are very relevant to Cain's exile. And it's just a few of them: to wander, to move, to stagger, to totter, to swing, to be unstable, to be tossed about or to be tossed around. So you can imagine that there's Cain. He's going out, but he really doesn't know where he's going. He's kind of wandering to and fro. And the second word is vagabond, and it's translated from another Hebrew verb, and a similar word to the first, and it's nud, N-U-W-D, and it's not the nude that we think of. Strong's number 5110, and it also has lots of very relevant meanings, and including to remove, to flee, to waver, to wander, to move to and fro, and to take flight. And again, very, very, very relevant to Cain's situation there. But the general intent of the two words, when we apply them to Cain, are that due to God's command, he was sent out, and he was sent on the road. Verse 16, and Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt. A Hebrew word is Yashab, we're going to talk about that later, and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. Now, we don't know how far the land of Nod was away from Eden. We know it was east of Eden. We don't know how far east of Eden it was. But the implication was that that Adam and Eve had not travelled very far from Eden as they were commanded, and neither did Cain. Cain stopped. He came to a full stop, and it says that he dwelt in the land of Nod. Again, we're going to examine the word dwelt in a couple of minutes. He dwelt in the land of Nod, which was at an unknown distance east of Eden. But apparently, from what we can read, what we can glean from these chapters, these early chapters of the scriptures, apparently Adam and Eve and Cain did not stay on the road for very long, and because of that they did not contribute very much to the overspreading of the whole earth, initially anyway. Verse 17, and Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he, Cain, builded a city. He builded a city, that's important, and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. Enoch. So again, from what we've read so far, and from what we're going to learn later on, I don't believe that God would have been very pleased with Cain, because he really did not, initially he accepted his punishment from God, he wasn't very happy about it, but from what this says, he really, in the long term, he refused to accept his God-given punishment as a fugitive and a vagabond. I don't think that God would have been pleased with him for stopping so soon. Apparently, again, we don't know the distance, but apparently quite near to Eden. And I don't believe that God would have been pleased with him for building a city. On the positive side, though, once he had done so, the multiplication of the human population got going in earnest, because now we had Adam and Eve, we're still having children. They had another son. Cain had another brother by the name of Seth, and so from Adam and Eve and Seth, and from Cain and their wives, again, who were obviously children of Adam and Eve, the multiplication of the human population got going in earnest. Okay, verse 20, and these were some of the descendants of Cain. Verse 20, and this is an interesting verse. And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of such as dwell in tents, and of such as have cattle. Now it's interesting that God would specify in these early lineage verses this, it seems like a very small point about the descendants of these people being tent dwellers. And I wonder if, again, it seems like a minor point, but I wonder if God felt that such nomadic people were obeying his commands by spreading themselves across the face of the earth better than Adam and Eve had done, better than Cain had done. As Cain, who took upon himself to give up the nomadic life so quickly and to settle down into city life. Anyway, with more children from Adam and Eve and more children from their children, the population multiplication did continue, and the migrations across the face of the earth did continue. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 1. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 1. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them. Don't want to get into all of the rest of that, but this brings us up to the time of Noah. And the next section here is talking about the the pre-deluge and the post-deluge. So we all know what caused God to bring the great flood upon the earth, and we don't need to rehearse all of that again today. But there are a few pre-flood verses that are very relevant to God's desire for Noah's progeny to resume the migration, both human and animal, across the face of the whole earth after he had wiped out most of the air-breathing life by means of the flood. So we're up to Genesis chapter 7, and this is the Lord Yahweh speaking to Noah. Verse 2, Genesis chapter 7 and verse 2. Of every clean beast you shall take to you by sevens, the male and his female, and of the beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female. Of fowls also of the air by sevens, the male and the female, look at this now, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth, all the earth. So we clearly see that the Lord wanted animals and humans to repopulate the whole world, he says, upon the face of all the earth. And then we come to chapter 8. And so after the flood, we don't have to go into the details of the flood, but after the flood, when God first brought Noah and his extended family and the animals out of the ark, is what we see. Genesis chapter 8 and verse 15. And God, Elohim, spoke unto Noah, saying, go forth of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, bring forth with you every living thing, look at this, every living thing that is with you of all flesh, both of fowl and of cattle, and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, that they may breed abundantly in the earth and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. So God commanded Noah and his family and all the animals, and of course he knew how to command the animals, he had the power to command the animals to go forth into the earth and upon the earth, and in modern English we would probably say around the world for those phrases. But as the floodwaters receded, God wanted them all, both human beings and all the animals and birds, to scatter themselves all across the newborn earth, with the accents on the word scatter. Now, this would happen quite naturally if they'd only obey two simple but very important key instructions from God. And there they are, and I'm repeating them, you don't have to turn back there. Genesis chapter 1 verse 28, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. That's number 1. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. They sound like simple things, but both of them, if you think about it, both of those things are being flagrantly disobeyed in modern Israel today. Flagrantly disobeyed. I'm going to come back to that later. Did Noah and his family obey those two rules? Well, kind of. Initially, but not fully. Not wholeheartedly, as we're going to see. We're still in chapter 8, verse 18. Chapter 8, verse 18. And Noah went forth, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him. So they didn't leave their mother and father. Now, it may have been excusable and understandable for these eight flood survivors to want to remain together, at least initially. I'm saying perhaps not. God is the judge, I'm not. So, verse 19, every beast, every creeping thing, and every fowl, and whatsoever creeps upon the earth after their kinds, went forth out of the ark. In the long term, we're going to see that these animals, every creature, all of these things, were more obedient to God's commands than the human beings were. So then in the next chapter, God repeated this command to them all, using somewhat different words. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 1. And we're speeding through the book of Genesis here, I know. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 1. And God, Elohim, blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish. What? Replenish what? Just the area around Mount Ararat where the ark had landed? Or just the area between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea? Or just the fertile crescent between Tigris and Euphrates? No. The second half of the verse says, the earth. Multiply and replenish the earth. Now, by means of this worldwide flood, God had decimated the whole world, the whole earth, of all air-breathing, inhabitants, except for the residents of the ark. And now, he wanted the survivors to replenish the whole earth. And he repeats this command yet again in verse 7. Verse 7, and you, be you fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. So again, lots of commands from God, reminders to go forth and to bring forth. So Noah and his family, they started out doing what they'd been told to do. They went forth from the ark and they started on the journey. Verse 18. And the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. Okay. Now it seems, not sure of the exact time in here, but it seems that by this juncture in the account, a ninth human being, a baby boy, Canaan, had been born to Noah's son Ham. And Mrs. Ham too, of course. Verse 19, these are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. Well, yes it was. Eventually anyway, after some notable deferrals, which we're going to come to. I'm not the judge of Noah or of anybody else, but although there are many scriptures that describe Noah as having been righteous, it talks about righteous Noah in a couple of different places, maybe, and again I'm not his judge, but maybe all the work and all of the stress of the building and preparing of the ark had worn him out, if you think of what that would have, you know, how much stress that would have taken, the toll that it would have taken on him. Maybe, and again this is a big maybe he thought that he deserved a rest. And why do I say that? Because rather than leading his sons and his daughters-in-law and his grandson to continue this quest that was commanded to resume the repopulation and the overspreading of the earth, Noah and his extended family soon came to a full stop. A full stop. Verse 20, and Noah began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard. Now, maybe they had moved some way down from Mount Ararat to a more fertile area, having good soil, but they decided to put down roots, and you can take that as a pun if you like, they decided to put down roots right there and settle down into the life of gentlemen farmers. Was that a poor decision? I believe that it was. But if it was, it sparked some history-changing problems. Verse 21. And he, talking about Noah again, he drank of the wine, the Hebrew word is yayin, he drank of the wine and was drunk, and he was uncovered within his tent. There's a couple of things you can see here. At this point in the account, quite a bit of time had gone by since their arrival at Ararat. And there's a couple of reasons why we know this. And we know this because it takes time for the vines to mature, for grapevines to mature to the point of being ready to bear grapes, grapes that are fit for winemaking. And I looked it up, and one expert there that I found, one expert source says up to 3 years before a vine will bear grapes that are ready for making good wine. And it also takes time for good wine to be made and to be matured. Now we know that Noah's wine was not new wine. The Bible talks about new wine in a lot of different places, but the Hebrew word for new wine throughout the Old Testament is the word tirosh, T-I-Y-R-O-W-S-H, tirosh. But the Hebrew for fully matured wine is yayin, and this was yayin. And it's so we believe that it took time to fully mature. Also, the other thing that we see from this verse 21 is that even after possibly 3 years or more since their arrival at Ararat, Noah grew a vineyard. He grew a vineyard even before he built a house, because this verse says that he was still living in a tent. He was still living in a tent. Verse 20 that we read a couple of minutes ago there says that Noah only began to be a husbandman at that time. If that is true, then that would indicate that he had no former experience in vineyard husbandry. And apparently got his priorities mixed up. He probably did not have much experience with drinking wine either, from what happened. Let's just continue with it. Verse 22. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren outside. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both of their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine, and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. They were prophecies for the future, but there was a curse on Canaan there too. And there's different opinions, if you look at the different Bible commentaries, there are different opinions as to whether it was Ham or Canaan who did the bad deed, whatever the bad deed was. So we ask the question, was it Canaan who was cursed because of what he'd done himself? Was it Canaan who did it and he received the curse? Or was Canaan cursed because of what his father Ham had done? We might say, if that's the case, then that wasn't fair. But you can find quite a few scriptures that tell us that at that time, the Lord frequently visited the iniquity of the fathers on the children unto the third and fourth generation of people who hated him. So, does that come into it? Again, we don't know all of the fine detail. We don't know exactly what was done to Noah. It may have been something nasty, or it may have been something as relatively, what we might think of as relatively innocent, as ridicule, playful ridicule of a silly, tipsy old man, a silly old dad or a silly old granddad. But whatever it was, God didn't look upon it as innocent. And this is a side point to in the sermon, but there's various scriptures that tell us that God takes very seriously, our respect for the elderly, and I'm not saying this because I'm becoming elderly, but God does take our respect for the elderly very seriously, even connects, I don't want to go into the scriptures right now, but even connects the grey hair of the elderly and our proper respect for them with righteousness and with a fear of himself. You might remember in the book of Kings, the Second Kings, where God sent two she-bears, to maul a bunch of youths who were disrespectfully taking the mickey out of Elisha and his boldness. But anyway, again, I'm not Noah's judge, but I do feel that Noah must, in the resurrection, he must take some of the blame on what happened here, because if he and his family had stayed on the road as they were commanded, if he had not come to a full stop, he wouldn't have grown a vineyard. And if he wouldn't have grown a vineyard, he wouldn't have had all of that wine to drink in excess. And he wouldn't have got drunk, and this problem never would have taken place, and history would have been changed. As far as Noah himself was concerned, there was no continuing history regarding him after this, other than that he was blessed to live a long life. But even though he may have been a good, righteous man, he was still human, and he eventually went the way of all flesh. Verse 29, and all the days of Noah were 950 years. That's pretty good going. 950 years, and he died. Problem here is the timing. He died at 950 years old, and I believe that. I believe that is true. But we're going to see, as we're going to leave chapter 9 now, and we're going to move into chapter 10. And I want to preface the next section of the sermon by telling you that I don't believe that the timeline that the Bible presents right here is the actual sequence of when things happened after the wine incident. And the scriptures do this sometime. I'm not saying that the scriptures are wrong. I'm not saying that the people who wrote it wrote something wrong. It's just that the Bible, the scriptures do sometimes make a basic statement, and then they go back in time and fill in the details. You find that with Adam and Eve. You know, it says that they were created, and then it goes back again a couple of chapters later and goes into more details. And I believe that's what happened here. We know that Noah, at the time of the flood, we know what his age was, 600 years old. We know how old he was when he died, 950. But we don't know how old he was at the time of the wine incident. That's just an example. It gets kind of interesting here because the Babel account follows right on now as we move on here into chapter 10. The Babel account follows directly after the mention of Noah's death, and because of that we tend to assume that it actually occurred, that the Babel account, the Babel incident, actually occurred soon after Noah's death. But there's a very, very good possibility, I'd say probability, that Noah was still alive at the time of the Babel incident. If we look at the timelines of the ages of the patriarchs, Noah died just 2 years before the birth of Abraham. And you think about that, and this presents some, not problems, but supplementary questions, which we're going to go through as we go forward now. But let's put the time of Noah's death on the back burner just for a few minutes, and let's move on with the activities of his progeny. What did they do next? What did they do? Did they continue to go forth and scatter themselves across the face of the earth as they were commanded by the Lord? Before we answer that question, let's start into chapter 10 and let's just look at a few details of the generations of the families of Shem, Ham and Japheth. And some interesting points here and relevant points to what I want to say. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 1. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 1. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham and Japheth, and unto them were sons born after the flood. After the flood. And the sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Tiras, etc., etc. Jump down to verse 5. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, and after their families in their nations. Now, this says, again, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided. Now this dividing did not happen till after the Babel or the Babel incidents. And also, by the way, it mentions the isles of the Gentiles. There wasn't any such thing as a Gentile for many, many years after this. A Gentile is a non-Israelite, and there was no such of a thing as a Gentile, at least until the time of Jacob, whose name was Israel, and Esau. Okay, but now let's jump down to Shem. Let's jump over, and we'll come back again, but let's go down to verse 22. And let's talk about Shem, the children of Shem. In verse 22, the children of Shem, Elam, and Ashur, and Arphaxad, and Lud, wonderful names, and Aram, and on there. Jump down to verse 30. And their dwelling was from Mesha, as you go unto Sephar, a mount of the east. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. And once again, this is after the Babel incident. After the Babel incident. And now for our purposes, let's back up again. Let's go back to, still in chapter 10, let's go back up to verse 6 in chapter 10, verse 6, and let's home in on the genealogy of Ham. Now I'm not totally sure whether or not this is significant, but Ham, of all three of Noah's sons, Ham receives the most attention here. He gets 15 verses compared with 10 verses for Shem and only 4 verses for Japheth. But let's take that for what it is, and let's go into verse 6. And the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim. Cush is the one to note there. And Mizraim and Phut and Canaan. And the sons of Cush are Seba and Havilah and Sabtah and Raama and Sabtika. And the sons of Raama, Sheba and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. That's important. And he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. The word is panim for before, and it means against the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before or against the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Achad, and Calne in the land of Shinar. So please note there who the king of Babel was, of Babel, and it was Nimrod. And through all of this, what about Canaan? What about Ham's son Canaan, who had been cursed by Noah? Well, it goes into the detail of him as well in verse 15. Let's take a quick look at that. Verse 15, and Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and on and on. Verse 18, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. And then afterward, and likely talking about after Babel, afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as you come to Gerar, unto Gaza. It might be significant for the modern troubles there, as you go into Sodom and Gomorrah, probably significant for what happened there, and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lashah. Verse 20, these are the sons of Ham, after their families, after their tongues, in their countries and in their nations. Jump all the way down to verse 32, these are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. Not just after the flood, though, but also after Babel. After Babel. So now we're going to go into verse 11, and as we go into verse 11, let's ask the same question again. Did Noah's children continue to scatter themselves across the face of the earth as commanded by the Lord? Verse 1, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Now when it says the whole earth, you have to remember they had not been out of the ark and down from Ararat for very long. You know, probably say about 100 years. So the whole earth at this point was referring to, and remember, it was only Noah's children who we're talking about here. So we're referring to the 8 surviving people from the ark who'd been on the road, plus those who'd been born to them by this time. So then we ask the question, how much time had gone by since they left Ararat, since the flood, and the various genealogies and everything show that it was about 100 years. Now there was only, we know that from Noah to Nimrod was only a space of 3 generations: Noah to Ham, Ham to Cush, Cush to Nimrod. It was only 3 generations. Now still, if they'd been obeying God by being fruitful and multiplying for all of those 100 years, there could very well have been quite a bunch of them by this time. Okay, verse 2, still in Genesis 11, verse 2, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. The first question on this, about this verse, is who were they? Says, and it came to pass, they journeyed. Who were they? Two possibilities here. There's a possible implication from the genealogy verses about Ham and Cush and Nimrod that it's just talking about the Hamites. That's the first possibility. But the most commonly accepted one is the second one. Is it talking about all of the people from the ark and their children? The Shemites and the Hamites and the Japhethites, who represent the whole earth, as implied by verse 1 of chapter 11. As implied by verse 1 of chapter 11, following on right after the last verse of chapter 10. And that view, that second view, again, is the usually accepted view. But think about this now. If this second view was truly the case, and if it was Nimrod who was spearheading the building of the tower and the city, which we believe it was, then it's important for us to remember that Noah, who lived for 950 years, was probably still alive at the time of the Babel episode. Keep that in the back of your mind there. We'll come back to that. Let's just throw some very approximate dates around here. Noah was born, and I'm giving you, I've got a big time chart of biblical history there, and these dates are from them, and they're approximate, but let's just use them for our purposes now. So Noah was born about 2948 BC, and he lived for 950 years. So that would bring him up to, so he died about 1998 BC. His son Ham was born about 2443 BC. The flood took place about 2348 BC, when Noah was 600 years old. Cush was born shortly after the flood, possibly about 2340 BC. Nimrod was born about 2295 BC. The Babel attempt occurred approximately 2247 BC, which was about 100 years after the flood. So then, from these numbers, we see that Noah was about 700 years old at the time of the attempted building of the Tower of Babel. And he still had 250 years of human life left to live. So again, we know that Noah died only 2 years before the birth of Abraham. And this leads to more questions from these things. We don't have all the answers. We have lots of questions. But they're interesting questions, and they show what was happening here. Where was Noah at the time of the Babel incident? Where was he? Did he stay back in his vineyard? Or did he maintain his leadership over his family, his extended family, who were burgeoning by then? Or was Nimrod effective in usurping Noah's leadership? If Noah did maintain the overall leadership of his extended family, and if he was present at Babel, is it plausible that he, who is righteous Noah, is it plausible that he would have allowed the building of the city, or the attempted building of the city and of the Tower of Babel? Interesting questions. Again, we don't have all the answers. The other interesting thing in this verse is that it says that they journeyed from the east. it may not be totally relevant to the sermon, but this is the geography. I think about the geography of the phrase. I looked on the map and I tried to come to that. They came off Mount Ararat. I don't know whether you have a map in the back of your Bible, or take a look on a Bible atlas and see if you can locate where Mount Ararat was, and see if you can locate where Shinar and Babel were located. What you'll see is that Ararat was not east of Shinar. It was actually far north of Shinar. And again, it's not a big deal, but the only really logical explanation of this detail is that perhaps they travelled south and then east. And that would make sense, because if they travelled south from Ararat, they could have come down the Tigris River Valley rather than, if they came right down the middle, they could be going over some steep and rough mountain roads. If they came down the river valley, it'd be a lot easier for them, and then they would have had to walk westward into Shinar. So that would make a lot of sense that they would do. But anyway, whatever was the actual case, once they arrived at the plain of Shinar, what did they do? And we're still in verse 2 here. What did they do? They dwelt there. They dwelt. Here's that word again, dwelt. They dwelt there. Now, did they dwell there, what, temporarily? Did they dwell there nomadically? Did they dwell there on their way to repopulate the earth as God had commanded them? Well, no. Again, the Hebrew word for dwelt right here is the same as the one used for Cain's halt, for Cain's stoppage. When Cain stopped east of Eden in the land of Nod, and where he built his city. The word is Yashab, Y-A-S-H-A-B, Strong's 3427, and it can mean to sit, to abide, to inhabit, to remain, to tarry, to continue, to sit down, to be set, to stay, and to have one's abode. So, by all accounts, when we read that one little word, Yashab, we believe that they were there for good. They built a city, or they tried to build a city. They were there for good, or at least they thought that they were there for good. And let's look back, let's think about it from a human point of view. If we give these Noahites the benefit of the doubt, they'd been on the road for 100 years. It may not be a long time if you live in 950 years, but perhaps it was natural for them to have wanted to put down roots. Most people today prefer not to be nomadic. Well, we mentioned before that there still are some groups around the world who seem to like to be nomadic, to like the nomadic way of life. We think about the Bedouin people who live in the Middle East and North Africa. We think about the Tinkers and the Romani, they used to call them gypsies. That's not politically acceptable anymore. The Tinkers and the Romani people of Europe, and even some North American Indian tribes, First Nations tribes, who seem to like the nomadic way of life. But most people don't. And we might conclude that the Noahites, they might have thought that it was okay, because trying to be logical about it, they knew that God wanted them to scatter themselves across the earth, the whole world, but it would surely be obvious and acceptable to him that various groups of them would eventually arrive at their final dwelling places, and that perhaps they ask themselves, is this it? Was this it? Is Babel the place? This is what happened, verse 3. And they said one to another, look at this, go to. And I wonder when it says they said one to another, and I wonder if it was Nimrod who was staring this up. They said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And this actually indicates that they possessed a fair level of technology. We look at this and we think of slime, and it sounds very low tech. But if you look it up, the Hebrew noun is chemar, C-H-E-M-A-R, and it can mean a kind of processed bitumen-based asphalt. So these guys knew what they were doing. Verse 4, and they said, again, go to. It's like, you know, staring each other up here. They said, go to, let us make brick. And here in verse 4, they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Now, we know that at least one of these people, maybe three, maybe four of them, had the ability to be involved in the building of the ark, the amazing ark, which must have been an astonishing piece of engineering. It was engineered by God, so it must have been. But it would be no surprise that these people also were able, had the ability to build a city and a grand tower. But again, what we're seeing here is that this was no temporary sojourn. The fact that these people were building a city proves that they intended to stay for good. Different teams of archaeologists have found various sets of remains in what they believe was the Babel area, and they've been claimed to be the actual ruins of the Tower of Babel. Again, there's various claims, so I'm not sure. Some archaeologists and Bible scholars believe that this Tower of Babel might have been what they call a ziggurat, which was an early type of pyramid before the Egyptians had their pyramids. Some scholars believe some biblical scholars believe that this tower project, the Tower of Babel project, might have been a Satan devised plan, again using Nimrod as a mouthpiece, in order to get to the third heaven and to depose God and to take over the rulership of the universe. Obviously not going to happen, but considering how technically advanced they obviously were to be able to build a city and to be able to build this wonderful tower, I asked myself, did they really believe that the top of their tower could reach to the third heaven? Did they really believe that? Or there is some evidence, and again some scholars or experts believe that this reference to reaching heaven might be because the tower could have been intended to be some kind of observatory, perhaps for astrological purposes rather than astronomical ones. Again, we have lots of questions. We don't have all of the answers. And I'm out of time for today. We're going to continue next time in part two, and we're going to go back to the Babel account. And the main point that I'm trying to get across in this first sermon of the series is that in those early years, both what we can call post-Eden and the post-deluge years, that it was clearly God's will and clearly God's command for the people to get out there and to repopulate the whole world. There's also an implication, and this doesn't really appear until later in the biblical account, that he wanted them to take his way of life along with them. And of course, for them to live by it, by his way of life, as they went along, obviously both on the road and wherever they finally settled. But we'll get into more of that next time.